a lot of work to do this morning, and so we're going to try to move as rapidly as possible so that people can have their bills heard. And my intention is to start with Senate Bill 321. As we have members come, we'll go into the work sessions on 2249 and 2389, and then we'll have the public hearings on 2639, 2714, and 2718. So that gives you an idea of the timing of when your bill will be up, I hope. Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 321, and I'm going to call Representative Krieger and Representative Berger. And the staff will read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 321 allows the Public Utility Commission to approve a contract authorizing Coos County to construct a natural gas pipeline that the territory allocated to another person providing natural gas to Coos County. It provides that the contract may contain terms for allocation of industrial customers in Coos County and other persons, and it declares an emergency effective upon passage. Thank you.
Good morning. Welcome. Ah, Senator Messner is here. Didn't see you.
Surprise.
Welcome.
Good morning. Chair Post, members of the committee, for the record, I am Joanne Berger from District 9, which is the Southern Oregon coast. It includes a part of Coos County, part of Douglas County, and a part of Lane County. Senate Bill 321 takes care of the last piece of housekeeping business for the Coos County pipeline. It has passed through both the General Government Committee and the Senate with unanimous votes. In 1997, the legislature approved $4 million for the engineering and feasibility study of the pipeline. Then in 1999, the legislature approved $20 million in lottery funds for the pipeline to move natural gas from the interstate pipeline near Roseburg to Coos County, contingent on a bond measure in Coos County to provide matching funds. The bond measure passed, even though it required a double majority. Since natural gas is regulated at the wholesale level, Coos County will own the pipeline. As a result, an agreement between Coos County and Northwest Natural must outline a procedure on how the two entities will negotiate with industrial customers for natural gas services. The Public Utility Commission concluded that it did not have the authority to approve the contract. Senate Bill 321 allows the Commission to approve a contract that provides for the allocation of customers in Coos County without allocations of territory. This is limited to Coos County. The measure had an emergency clause attached so that it can take into effect the governor's signature instead of January 2004. The county is ready to begin construction this spring. In fact, we should have this done before April 1st. Because Northwest Natural is a regulated utility, they want the approval, obviously, of the PUC, their regulator, before they proceed with this part of the project. Senate Bill 321 does that. It's a simple bill. We urge your support so that construction can begin.
Good morning, Chair Coles, committee members. For the record, I'm Wayne Krieger, state rep in District 1. As the good representative from the South Coast, Coos Bay, has outlined pretty well the whole issue for you, I think it also needs to be said that really the opportunity that the Governor Kilingoski wants for economic development in rural Oregon is dependent on this type of activity. And I think that, to me, is key, the opportunity and family wage jobs in the future. And really, it is a technical fix simply giving the PUC authority to regulate. And as already stated, there's a timeliness to this because in the works, ready to move, are some contracts and the ability to start that construction and to get these things online in a soon and orderly manner. So I would hope that we could get this thing moved. It's really important with Southern Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Ken Messerly, State Senator from District 5. I just wanted to be here today and be able to answer any questions or add support to my colleagues. This has been a long journey since 1997, and first getting the engineering funding, the $4 million plus, and then the $20 million for the construction, getting the bond issue through. This is the last leg. As has been stated, it's very important that we complete this so that they can start construction either by the end of this month or first part of April. We're already hearing reports that haven't been able to haven't been public yet of some very good investments that are planning on coming to Coos Bay and probably be made public in the very near future as soon as we can confirm that this construction is moving forward. So it's very important for the South Coast, the entire region, and I strongly urge your support.
Well, I want to, on behalf of the committee, to congratulate you on all your hard work on this bill. I know it's been a long road, and you've been here probably the longest, Senator Messerly. So we're very happy to hear the bill this morning.
Thank you.
Questions, Representative Schaffler?
Thank you. How many folks will it employ, and are there folks down there ready to go to work right now, I'd assume, that live there?
Well, actually, our employment has improved with American Bridge, we're hoping, of course, for it to continue to go down. I think that with natural gas, obviously, the overhead expenses of industrial customers is going to be far more appealing than it's been in the past. In fact, I would venture to say that we had a couple of industrial customers who would still be in business had they not had the high overhead that they've had to be forced with and did not have natural gas. So we think that we will have more companies looking at us, and we do have more companies looking at us. After all, we have almost everything in place now. It has taken us since the early 80s to do it, but we have a 30-year residence water supply now. We will have natural gas. We have a cancer center treatment. We have dormitories at our college. We have really worked very, very hard, and all the people in that area have worked hard to put infrastructure in place, and they've done much of it without state assistance. This has been a wonderful job with state assistance through this, and it has taken a long time, but that's all right. We feel that we're very accountable by having it take as long as it has. We're just eager now with this one little piece so that they can sign the contracts that construction can begin.
Thank you. Yep. Senator?
If I could comment to Chair Close, Representative Schaffler. There is, as I stated earlier, great interest in companies that want to come in and bring employees. I don't have the numbers for that interest at this point. But even more important is the mills that we already have in the area that are struggling to compete for energy. The Roseburg Lumber Company mill in Coquille is very anxious and has been very concerned that this project has been delayed to this point. We have a pulp mill from Weyerhaeuser and from the North Spit, another development that wants to come to the North Spit that I don't know how urgent they are, but they had talks with Northwest Natural, I do know that. And we have GP's sawmill in Coos Bay, who is, I think, interested in putting in dryers and those kind of things. Plus the hospitals and the schools and the community college and all the others that are looking for a more economical source of energy as well.
Senator Messerly, I'd like to ask you, from time to time I see the unemployment figures by county that come across my desk. Your county is always much higher than Linn County, which also is timber dependent. Do you recall what the unemployment rate is in Coos County right now?
Chair Close, I'm not sure what it is today or this month. It generally runs at least 2% above the state average. And there's been times when it's gone higher than that. But, you know, that's really misleading because we've had an awful lot of employees who have just simply left the area. And so they, as a matter of fact, there's another bill in the process here that's dealing with that in the enterprise zones. And because we've dropped below on the unemployment rate, but the economy hasn't improved at all. And so it's a very misleading figure, actually.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I'll call Lee Beyer, Commissioner of Public Utility Commission. And Gary, please. Okay.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. For the record, my name is Lee Beyer, Commissioner with the Oregon Public Utility Commission. We're here to support Senate Bill 321. We work closely with both Northwest Natural, the county, and the delegation, legislative delegation from the Southern Coast to bring this before you. It's a little deja vu for me. I think that I was a carrier of one of the original bills in this in my last term in the House to allow this to happen here, and found it very interesting as a public utility commissioner to find when it got to our desk that we did not have the legislative authority to approve the agreement that they brought to us. Certainly, it's an issue where you've had complete agreement between the legislative and the executive department that this is a good development project for the Southern Coast, and the only, barrier was the Utility Commission, which has the responsibility for allocating territory for natural gas utilities. We couldn't approve the agreement. So I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on this because I think the representatives and Senator Messerly did that, but just to say that we're supportive of this. It's a unique authority that we're asking for to recognize it in Coos County. I think this is the only example to date where a county has got as involved as they have, where the citizens have literally ponied up the money to try and bootstrap their economy. It's a good thing, and I'd encourage you to pass it.
Sorry, you can't carry it this.
That's perfectly fine.
Gary.
Thank you, Chair Close, members of the committee. Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural. Again, rather than just repeat everything, just even to clarify, it's the county will build the pipeline from the valley over to the to Coos County. Then we will build the local distribution system, and this just, as everybody said, is close that agreement on how we will work together on a number of matters. In addition, kind of the reason for the timeliness is that because we're regulated, we will not build the distribution system until we have the approval of our regulator. The county doesn't want to let the contracts to build the pipeline until they know that they have a distribution system at the end. So it's just our goal is to get this completed in time for the county to let contracts and begin construction later this spring, and then we will begin construction hopefully this summer. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Rosenbaum.
Gary, when do you kind of think that construction will be completed?
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, we actually hope, I think the county expects to have construction completed then by the end of the summer. And we have already have some staff in Coos Bay laying out the grid. And so as soon as they can get their part completed, we will have our construction underway. It will be a phased process. It's not that we build out the entire city all at once. And we think we can have some customers online before the end of the year.
Nicole, are there new jobs that are going to be created as part of this project, or are you just shifting people that you have in other parts of the state?
Chair, Close, Representative Rosenbaum, it will be a combination of shifting some people over there, some of our technical folks, as well as using some local people. And, of course, the construction process will be contractors coming in and working with both us and contractors working with the county. So we hope that there will be some opportunity for local jobs throughout this project.
Thank you. Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's no one else to testify on this bill, so I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 321. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 321. Representative Gallegos.
Oh, Madam Chair, I move that we the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gallegos moves Senate Bill 321 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Okay, seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Gallegos?
Aye.
Representative Ferrar?
Aye.
Representative Merkley?
Aye.
Representative Schaffler?
Aye.
Representative Kitz?
Is excused.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Chair Close?
Votes aye. Motion carries. And the bill moves to the floor. Congratulations. I think we would like to do co-carriers of Representative Verger and Representative Krieger. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to move to open a work session on House Bill 2389 and call forward Scott Berry. And committee, I believe we have some amendments.
The dash two amendments with that.
Do you want to give us a summary, Mayor, please?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, House Bill 2389, the amendments we have, the dash two, replaces the bill but keeps the intent of the original bill, establishes the notice of defect procedure for recovering damages for the residential construction defects prior to initiating arbitration or commencing collection. The amendments define the defect and remediation aspects. It allows the contractor that has been notified about a defect to conduct a visual examination prior to the inspection of the site. It specifies that a contractor sending a secondary notice and is holding a recipient liable for defect is to coordinate the scheduling of the inspection with the owner and the secondary recipients. And to do that in enough time to establish the bill. It specifies that the contractor's inspection report is what is to include as far as the existence or non-existence of defects. It established what documents from the defect process is admissible or inadmissible in arbitration if that is pursued. And it requires the contractor to deliver notice of this procedure and consumer notification form to the owner and specifies the language that is required in that bill.
Yes.
So those are some of the changes with the dash two amendments in the bill.
Welcome, Scott. Do you want to give us a little more material on any of what was mentioned?
Thank you, Chair Close, members of the committee, Scott Berry with the Oregon Building Industry Association, and I think Megan covered the amendments fairly well. I'd be happy to answer any questions on the bill. I think we've covered it and gone over it fairly exhaustively, but if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions? Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Scott. I'm still trying to get my hands around. Thank you very much for the chart to help this legislator understand the path through which this flows, and that path being a request, a concern expressed, and then by a consumer, a request from the builder for a visual inspection, and then the possibility of follow-up examination. One of the clauses in the bill says that within 20 days after a request from the builder, the homeowner needs to provide the opportunity for a visual inspection. If something goes wrong with that 20 days, for example, let's say the owner, not knowing about that 20 days, schedules, and the builder not being concerned about it, schedule it for 25 days out, and they go on through the process. At some point, is there the possibility that the ability for them to continue to pursue this claim becomes compromised because that sort of technical glitch in the process? Or would they have to start all over if this was brought to someone's attention later if a court case was filed?
Chair Close, Representative Merkley, that's certainly not the intent of the bill. I don't believe that would happen. The only hard and fast dates are the 14 days after the notice is received from the contractor. They need to get back to the homeowner. And then at that point, they start scheduling that visual examination followed by, if needed, the inspection. And then, of course, at the end, the final 120 days.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Gore.
Madam Chair, I would move that House Bill 2389.
This is a dash two.
I'm sorry, that the dash two amendments be approved and House Bill 2389.
Thank you. Representative Gerard has moved, the dash two amendment. Is there discussion? Is there objection?
I'll save my discussion for when we go to pass the bill.
Okay. So is there objection to the dash two? Okay, seeing none, so ordered. Representative Gerard?
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2389 be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gerard moves House Bill 2389 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion, Representative Merkley?
Thank you very much. This bill addresses a very important issue, which is bringing an owner into communication with the builder before we resort to lawsuits. One of my personal goals in life is to get through it without ever having to file a lawsuit. And I'm probably over halfway there, so another 45 years and we'll make it. I do have concerns that won't keep me from voting for this bill because it's the right idea. I have concerns because of the complexity. I'm concerned about the many, many stages. It took several of us looking at it very closely in conversation with the advocates to kind of figure out and understand the features, and I think this will be a challenge for an ordinary citizen. Several of my specific concerns have been very ably addressed by the proponents. I was concerned that the time period for filing suit would replace the 10-year statute of limitations, and upon close examination with the help of the advocates, we secured a conviction. Well, we reached a point where we were clear that that wasn't the case, that this would in fact extend the 10 years if necessary to enable someone, if they couldn't reach an accommodation with the builder. I was also concerned about some of the time periods creating technical glitches, and if a person has multiple problems with a house, which sometimes happens with a house, that you have now not just one pathway with this complicated chart, but you now have four or five complicated charts tracking when everything happens. But I think that we have to keep in mind, and I'm expressing this from my own sense of how I've gotten to a comfort zone with this, that this comes after the Construction Contractors Board process, which is where most housing defects have their chance to be remedied early on, and that probably citizens will come to utilize this when they go to a lawyer and say, I couldn't get something remedied earlier and I'm concerned. And the lawyer will now say, not that I will take your case to court, but there is a process that I can help guide you through in the best possible communication with the builder to resolve this problem. I wanted to find out how this had worked in other states. And my staff is trying to contact several states to get feedback on how it's worked elsewhere. In fact, the two states she's trying to contact have had it in place, I gather, only about a year, so there may not be much of a track record, and I wasn't able to get responses in time for now. But I think I kind of a sense of faith with the industry that I think their intent is right, and if there are glitches we hit in the system, I feel confident that they'll be back in helping us to iron those out in the next session. So with that complicated explanation, I salute the purpose of this bill and hope that it helps people get their houses fixed and helps people stay out of court.
Thank you, Representative Merkley. I think that you speak for a number of the members on that. Representative Shoffer.
Thank you. I'm concerned about the consumer, too, and their rights and their ability to sue. I think this isn't designed to go for good contractors, good guys. This gives the lawyer of a consumer a process to go after bad guys, because bad guys aren't going to respond. That 14 days will be, they aren't going to respond. And now they can say they've went through these steps, which is giving them another a tool in their bag of complaints to go after bad guys. And I just think it's a good idea, and I support it. But I share your concerns about people's ability to sue. There's no doubt about that. But thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Without further discussion, then, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Gallegos?
Aye.
Representative Berard?
Aye.
Representative Merkley?
Aye.
Representative Shoffler?
Aye.
Representative Pitts?
Excused.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Chair Close?
Both aye. Motion carries. And House Bill 2389 moves to the floor. And Representative Girard, will you carry this bill?
Be honored, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay, I'm closing the work session on 2389. Okay. I'm opening the work session on House Bill 2249 and calling forward
Stacey Warner.
Please come forward. And Megan, can you refresh our memory as they're coming up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2249, referred back to the end of January. It authorizes the state fire marshal to charge fees for maintenance and regulation of structural fire safety features in certain occupied structures, and authorizes the state fire marshal to charge permit fees for installation of ground storage tanks. We have the -2 amendments, which are consensus amendments. The state fire marshal office has worked with a number of folks on. I've supplied the amendments tool, the hand engrossed version for you in the packets. And the amendment specified that the fire marshal may charge residential care facilities a fee of no more than $75 upon application for a license of operation. And it specifies that the nursing facilities that are certified for Medicare and Medicaid are not subject to that fee. The amendments also exempt the local governments that operate the specified occupied structures in the statute from the fire marshal maintenance and regulation safety provisions. And it removes the language that the fire marshal charges fee for installation permits for above-ground storage tanks of the propane gas stove. So we dealt with that issue in House Bill 2248, which has been in our committee already. And this bill is has a referral to Ways and Means, so that's where we send it today. Thank you.
Good morning. I see you've done quite a bit of work, and we thank you for the work that you've done on this.
Thank you.
Tell us what you've done.
All right. Chair Close, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Stacy Warner. I'm the Fire and Life Safety Services Manager for the Office of State Fire Marshal Division of State Police. Since the first public hearing on this bill, I've worked with all of the various entities that voiced concern over specific language or concept in the bill, and all known issues, to my knowledge, have been resolved now to everyone's satisfaction. And the Dash 2 amendment before you is the result of that. Additionally, based on some testimony presented at that public hearing, I've entered into discussion with the Department of Human Services regarding some additional funds that may be available to us through the federal government.
And could you just explain the Medicaid match dollars?
Essentially, what that'll be is we put up some matching money, and then through the conduct of our inspections and re-inspections, there are portions of that then that are reimbursed back to us from the government. 50% match, approximately. That allows us to recoup some additional cost above and beyond the fee proposed.
And that was something we were not aware of before, correct?
Correct. I was not aware of that either, and so now we're working on that.
Very good. Questions? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you. Stacey, is that then the reason that the Medicare and Medicaid facilities are exempted from the fee that would be charged to other facilities? Or
they're already, we receive a 100% reimbursement from the federal government through a contract that we have with DHS, the Health Division, and services to people with disabilities. That this would be an additional fee on top of that, and so that's why they're exempted.
Other questions? All right, Kenny, we are in work session, and we have a Dash 2 amendment. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2249.
Representative Rosenbaum has moved the Dash 2 amendment into House Bill 2249. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Rosenbaum.
House Bill 2249 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Oh, I'm sorry. Can you rephrase that? I move House Bill 2249 as amended to Ways and Means Committee with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Rosenbaum has moved House Bill 2249 as amended to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Okay, seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bagels?
Aye.
Representative Berard?
Aye.
Representative Merkley?
Aye.
Representative Schaffler?
Aye.
Representative Kitts?
Is excused.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Chair
Close? Votes aye. House Bill 2249, as amended, moves to Ways and Means. Thank you very much. Thank you for your work, Steve.
Thank you.
Good job. Okay, I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2249. And I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2639 and calling Arlen Levy, Oregon Association of Realtors. And the staff will give the introduction.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2639 allows a real estate broker, principal real estate broker, or escrow agent to generate interest earnings on client funds held in trust to benefit a public benefit corporation for funding first-time home buyers assistance and development of affordable housing. Thank you.
Missing in action. Welcome, Harlan.
Good morning, Chair Close.
And committee, I'll just tell you we have about 10 people to speak on this. So we will ask people to try to keep their comments to about 3 minutes.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Yesterday morning in our Environment Committee, Harlan was late because of his newborn, and I'm just wondering, did you finally get a good night's sleep?
Chair Close, Representative Girard, no.
And I would also say that Jared Broadfoot is in the same situation here. He's not sleeping much either. He also has a new baby. We congratulate you both.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Close, members of the committee. For the record, I am Harlan Levy, staff attorney for the Oregon Association of Realtors. I'm here to support House Bill 2639, a bill that was sponsored at our request. The Oregon Association of Realtors is a nonprofit trade association. It represents approximately 13,000 realtor members across the entire state. And we thank you for this opportunity to present this testimony. We requested this bill because we wanted to do something positive to address the problem of the lack of affordable housing in Oregon. We recognize that home ownership contributes to community responsibility, economic stability, and family security. It provides a concrete value to communities because families have a financial stake in the well-being of their neighborhoods. However, the statistics on home ownership in Oregon are not good. According to the United States Housing and Urban Development, the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development analysis of the 2000 census, Oregon has the ninth lowest rate of home ownership in the country. Additionally, home ownership rates are actually going down, which is against the national trend. This is directly attributable to the lack of affordable housing we have here in Oregon. While we've had record low interest rates that have kept the housing market strong, it simply has not addressed the problem of low-income families that have been unable to afford a down payment to get into their house. According to the National Association of Home Builders Housing Opportunity Index, for the first quarter of 2002, Portland is 163rd out of 191 United States cities in terms of housing affordability. Eugene is 169th, and Salem is 157th. These are not good statistics. The lack of affordable housing is caused by a variety of factors, including excessive regulatory hurdles that we face here in Oregon, as well as high development fees. We brought this bill in order to try to reverse this trend, to try to do something positive to address this issue. What the bill does is it allows earnest money and escrow funds to be placed into an interest-bearing account to generate funds for the benefit of a charitable foundation that would be dedicated to first-time home buying assistance and the development of affordable housing. The Oregon State Bar has a similar program already set up. It's known as the Interest on Lawyer Trust Accounts program, where client retainers are put into interest-bearing accounts and the interest goes to support legal aid. So the banks have the apparatus in place to do this. Clients of real estate agents would be given written notice that their funds would be deposited into one of these accounts before the funds were deposited. And presumably they would have a choice not to participate because the program is voluntary for agents. So there would presumably be some agents out there that would not participate. But we are going to try to encourage this, create a culture of charity, that this is a good thing for our agents to do and encourage them to participate. We are looking forward to working with other affected industries and organizations in the near future to set up the charitable foundation. What we have done is we've looked at other states that have done this, including Colorado, and they have a successful program there. And I've attached to my written testimony one page from the Colorado Association of Realtors website. I would encourage members of the committee, if they have some time, to go to the website. There's a whole variety of information there about this wonderful program they've set up in the state of Colorado. In Colorado, they generate between $300,000 and $500,000 annually toward these ends, and the money goes directly to this foundation which then distributes it out to those organizations and individuals that need it. And I wanted to note that the 85% of the money that goes in ends up going out for this purpose. So there's only a 15% administrative loss, and I think that's a very good percentage. In conclusion, we strongly believe in the American dream of homeownership. I'm sure most of you have seen our slogans that we are in the American dream business. That is true. That's what our members do. And we are committed to seeking constructive solutions to this affordable housing crisis that we have here. And this bill is a positive step in that direction. Sure, it's not going to solve the crisis. It's not going to put everybody into a home that should be in a home. But if we can get 1,000 families into a home each year that otherwise would not be in a home, I think that's a great thing. That's something that we should be proud of. We anticipate that this will give many of those low-income families an opportunity to own their own home, and that benefits us all. So, in conclusion, we respectfully request that you support this legislation, and thank you for this opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to entertain any questions you might have.
Thank you, Harlan. Very fascinating concept. You mentioned that there were realtors, that this would be voluntary for realtors, and I was just wondering if the money's going into an account anyway, why some might be opposed to that.
Chair Close, I don't know why they would be opposed to it. Right now, they're not getting that interest anyway, so
just gives them the opportunity.
This just creates tools. This is a tool to generate a new fund that does not exist today, and we're going to very much encourage that it be participated in.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Who currently gets the interest that is generated?
Chair Close, Representative Merkley, nobody does, so that means the banks technically get to keep the money.
Don't the owners of the funds sometimes accrue that interest back to themselves?
Chair Close, Representative Merkley, there is a provision in current law with a prior written approval of all parties that have an interest in the funds, then a real estate broker may accrue the interest to inure to that benefit. And for purposes of escrow accounts, with prior written approval of all parties, it can go to the escrow agent as well. That requires everybody's written consent.
It's interesting how this current law is written as the negative, that is, without such collaboration, it shall not inure to the benefit of the broker. I had assumed that meant that without such an agreement, it accrued to the benefit of the person, the owner of the funds. But you're saying that isn't really the way it works in practice.
Chair Close, Representative Merkley, I believe you're looking at the subsection 5 and section 1 and subsection 2 and section 2. Those amendments were drafted by LC. We did not request those.
I was looking at current law. What's being taken out? Current law that's being taken out in this amendment, in this bill. Under current law, the interest to go to the broker requires a written agreement of all parties, but it's silent as to where that interest goes if there isn't such an agreement. And I just wanted to clarify whether currently that interest may go back to the owner of those funds, that is, the person buying the property.
Chair Close, Representative Merkley, I believe with written consent of all parties, that would be permissible.
Representative Schaffer.
Thank you. If you said this earlier, I missed it, I'm sorry. How much will this generate, and how many folks will we get into homes a year approximately? Do you have any estimates on, or what is Colorado? How many folks do they get in?
Chair Close, Representative Schaffler. In Colorado, they raise between $300,000 to $500,000 a year. And if you extrapolate that, you know, a typical down payment for a moderately priced home may be $5,000, you could say that they get perhaps 1,000 people per year, but I'm just estimating.
Mm-hmm. And do you think, excuse me, Mary?
A follow-up.
Will we generate, our housing real estate industry generate comparable or more or less money and get that many folks into houses? Do you have any estimates on that, please?
Chair Close, Representative Schaffer, I haven't done a detailed analysis of comparisons between the Colorado real estate market and the Oregon market. However, in terms of population, we are relatively close to their population.
Thank you.
Representative Merkley, and then we do need to move on.
Madam Chair, thank you. In Colorado, does the same option exist for the interest to go either to the homeownership fund or to the brokers?
Chair Close, Representative Merkley, yes, it is a voluntary program in Colorado as well.
Do you know what percent of money participates or what percent of transactions participate in the homeownership fund?
Chair Close, Representative Merkley, I do not know.
Thank you.
Okay, well, Harlan, thank you very much for presenting this. We would like to bring you back as questions arise, but I want to move to the other people to testify so we can take theirs as well. So,
thank you very much.
Can you stay?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to call Gary Conkling, Stuart Branham, and Michael Anderson up as a panel. Good morning.
I'll go ahead and go first, if I may. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Gary Conkling, here today representing Oregon Home, which is a public and private consortium formed to implement the consensus recommendations of metropolitan leaders for market-oriented strategies to address the growing problem of affordable housing. We are not taking a position today on House Bill 2639, and we would like to applaud the realtors for recognizing the severity of this problem and bringing forward at least a bill that addresses it. Our concern is that the problem far exceeds what this bill can deal with. In legislation introduced last session at the request of Oregon Home, we proposed a narrow exemption from the state's existing preemption on new local real estate transfer fees. The exemption was sought for a regional housing trust that would be established by the affirmative vote of a majority of cities and counties in the Portland metropolitan region. The measure would have permitted a real estate transfer fee to be imposed regionally, and it was estimated that the fee at a 0.75% rate would have generated $50 million annually for market-oriented incentives for affordable housing. As you heard, House Bill 2639 is unlikely to produce anything near that amount, and yet it seeks to address the problem on a statewide basis, not even on a regional basis. And more important, the problem of affordable housing is more complex than just first-time homebuyers. House Bill 2639 limits its benefits to first-time homebuyers. The Oregon Home proposal likewise contained secondary mortgage assistance for first-time homebuyers, but it also included provisions to deal with affordability for renters, especially senior citizens and disabled persons, people who find it extremely hard and increasingly hard to find housing nearby the communities where they participate and live. It's recognized, I think, by people who have studied this problem that we need a more sophisticated, complex strategy to tackle the problem. There certainly are no easy answers to ensure affordable housing, but there are some principles that have been widely embraced and that we urge you to consider as you review this or other affordable housing legislation. First, our goal should be to encourage and empower complete communities where people can afford to work and live, and where people are able to retire and be close to their families and their friends. A survey last year of metropolitan mayors indicated complete communities is one of the most widely shared aspirations that we have. A second principle is where possible we should move forward with consensus. In fact, the metropolitan region has a consensus that was hard fought and came about as a result of essentially a broad-based rejection of a regulatory approach to deal with affordable housing through inclusionary zoning, and in fact focused on market-oriented incentives, but those will only work, in fact, if there is funding to make those incentives come about. It's also part of the consensus that we need a range of options and incentives to ensure that housing stock is actually built and that we can find and accumulate the land in which to place it inside our urban growth boundaries. A third principle is that we need incentives that will cover not just home buyers, and we certainly want to encourage people to own a piece of the pie. That's obviously an aspiration we all have. But we also have to recognize that for many people, the reality is they will be in rental units, and we need to make sure that they are safe and adequate and dispersed throughout the region. And finally, the problem won't solve itself. It is a serious problem, and it needs a serious solution, and that solution means adequate funding to pay for the housing that we need. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Gary. That's very complete and well done. Let's go to Stuart.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stuart Branham, and I come to you today on behalf of the Oregon Disability Commission. The Oregon Disability Commission represents not only disabled people, but seniors throughout the state of Oregon. We're here to testify on behalf of House Bill 2639. Affordable housing throughout the state of Oregon is an ongoing issue no matter what community you attend. Governments and committees within governments are trying to address this issue daily. The Oregon Disability Commission doesn't think that House Bill 2639 goes far enough. We would like you to, this committee, to look at House Bill 2595, which talks about a real estate transfer fee. We think this real estate transfer fee would be a good item for a good tool for communities throughout the state of Oregon. We think it would help communities assist people with disabilities get into affordable housing. We believe that a bill like 2595 is more pliable for the communities. It is it gives more tools to the local governments in which real estate transfer fee would be implemented. So we encourage this committee to open up hearings on House Bill 2595, and we'd like to come back to you and testify on that. Thank you very much.
Well, I will respond to that. You know, I do understand that we have a housing crisis in Oregon. The problem's been well pointed out. However, because we're in an economic recession, we have high job loss, little job creation. I'm not real willing to put on new fees this session, but I know that this is an ongoing debate, and we appreciate knowing about it.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Shoffman.
All those other ideas you gentlemen talked about, this in no way will interfere with future ability to try and go those directions, will it? And I look at this just another way, another area to try and help a huge problem, how small as it may be. But it wouldn't interfere with trying to get to any of the other ideas you're all talking about, would it, if it did? Okay. Any one of you?
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, no, I don't think that it intrudes on a solution. My only concern would be that someone would view it as a solution.
Okay, Michael.
Hello, Chair Close and members of the committee. Thank you very much for having me speak today. My name is Michael Anderson, and I'm with the Community Development Network, a 21-member organization of community development organizations from Multnomah County. Our membership has developed over 50% of the affordable units of housing for people under 50% median family income in the metro area. Our members also run several different successful first-time home ownership programs in the metro area that also have had local and national recognition. HB 2639 is a laudable effort by the Oregon Association of Realtors to begin to address the vast affordable housing needs of our state. Would that a voluntary program that uses escrow interest were sufficient? Unfortunately, HB 2639, generating funding necessary to meet our state's housing needs, is like trying to fill the Grand Canyon with a garden hose. Even the loftiest revenue predictions for HB 2639, the funding generated by the for housing will not be nearly adequate to meet the very serious needs of Oregon. And what are those needs? Our grandparents choosing between paying rent and eating food? Our brothers and sisters with disabilities choosing between paying rent and purchasing necessary medication? Our young parents choosing between keeping their child in his or her school or relocating mid-school year because of escalating rents? Chair Close and members of the committee, there is a solution. We need a local option for a real estate transfer fee. HB 2595, another bill for your consideration, would allow local communities from Medford to Portland to address the housing crisis in their own backyards. A real estate transfer fee could be used for new home ownership opportunities, as well as meeting the desperate needs of Oregon's most vulnerable citizens. If HB 2639 is an initial move for the legislature to address affordable housing needs, then it is an excellent beginning. But if we're serious about affordable housing, we must lift the real estate transfer fee preemption. Thank you very much.
Questions? Okay. Representative Gerard.
Mr. Henderson, I think that we all would probably concur with what you're saying, but we're basically dealing with House Bill 2639 and not the other bills that you're making reference to. But this would appear to be a good step. And a step that's time to take with 2639. There's that old adage of how do you eat an elephant, and it's one bite at a time.
I agree very much, Chair Close and Representative Gerard. I think that's an excellent point. I think if we could get $500,000 new dollars for affordable housing, that would be wonderful. The City Club of Portland estimates that the need for just the City of Portland over the next 10 years, if we tried to solve the affordable housing crisis, would be well over $175 million a year. So I definitely think it's a very important step in the right direction. But in terms of meeting the need, we have such a long, long way to go.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you all for appearing and reminding us of the size of the problem and of other important strategies to address it. Would you also be willing to take a look at Colorado's program and, if we go down this route, take this small step, if you will, which is really an independent track, in a way, from a real estate transfer tax, and advise us whether there's any ways, mechanisms with which we should design it to make it work in the best possible way based on the experience of other states. I think it'd be very helpful to this committee.
Thank you for your testimony. I'm going to call Bob Repine. I don't see him in the audience, but Jack Kenny is probably here on his behalf. And is it Ian or Ian Slingerland? Ian? And John Blatt. Morning, Jack.
Good morning, Chair Close. Thanks for having us. Bob Repine had another meeting he had to get to, so I'll fill in.
Please give him our apologies. We would love to have had him.
He would very much love to be here.
Go ahead.
Okay. Again, my name is Jack Kenny. I'm the Deputy Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. I'd like to commend the realtors for this initiative to address the very important issue of assisting first-time home buyers and assisting the efforts to provide affordable housing to Oregonians. It's a mission that our department and the state shares with the realtors. It's my understanding that this proposal is going to be based on a very successful model from Colorado, and from the short time I've had to review that information from Colorado, it looks like that program has been successful and addresses some important issues that we share. It looks like it supports some of the same organizations that the state supports through our department. So, again, I believe this is an excellent first step as far as that goes. I'd like to point out that our department does have a successful down payment assistance program already in place that we administer through the Oregon Bankers Association and the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association. It has established rules in place regarding affordability and eligibility. It's done at a very low overhead because of our partnership with the bankers and the mortgage lenders. Similarly, our programs to provide grants for affordable housing are done with very low overhead and do have established mechanisms in place for competitive process and to ensure that low-income Oregonians are served. So having said that, again, I very much appreciate the efforts of the realtors and the discussion that's been held with this committee. You do eat the elephant, I suppose, one bite at a time, and this is this is an important step, and we appreciate that people are looking for creative approaches to addressing the needs of Oregonians to find affordable housing. We look forward to working with the realtors and other partners and to be at the table with the realtors as this concept is more thoroughly refined, and would appreciate an opportunity to provide our expertise and experience in this area to them as they move forward with this effort.
Welcome.
Well, thank you. Chairman Close and members of the committee, my name is John Blatt. I am with the Association of Oregon Community Development Organizations. We represent about 50 nonprofit community development corporations that develop low-income housing around the state and about 50 other organizations that help support them. Like you've heard today, we think that the realtors should be applauded for what they have done today. They have stepped up and found a source of income for first-time home buyers that was not there before, and we think that that is a great thing. But as you've heard, it also doesn't solve the problem, and I want to just put some of the things in perspective. Oregon is a good 2% below the national average for home ownership. The national average for home ownership is pushing about 68%, and Oregon is about 66%. That's, if we want to get up to that level, just up to the national average, Oregon needs to create about 20,000 new homeowners just to get up to that level. This bill, even if we get $500,000, actually $500,000 in $5,000 down payments is 100 down payments. So we're talking about supporting about 100 families a year getting into home ownership. And while that doesn't make a huge dent in the overall problem, on the other hand, to those 100 families, this is going to be a very significant event in their lives. So, as you've heard before, it doesn't make a huge dent in the overall affordable housing problem. It doesn't make a huge dent in the home ownership gap that we have between Oregon's home ownership rate and the national home ownership rate, but it does make a difference in that. We have a couple of things that we also have some concern about in the bill. The bill refers to affordable housing. That does not necessarily mean low-income housing or people who are in lower incomes. Affordable housing could be for anybody at any particular income. So we would like to see some of that language refined to target people who are really at the margins and might be homeowners if they could get the assistance at the low-income level. Oh, and we don't think this needs to be an amendment, and we've talked a little bit with the realtors about this. We would like to see this also plugged into the existing networks of homeowner education and down payment assistance. There's a study that was done by Freddie Mac that found that people who had gone through homeownership classes and who had been attached to networks that do homeowner education, do default prevention and foreclosure prevention, that those people actually stay in their housing at a higher rate than other people. So if you can connect these homeowners, these low-income homeowners, to these networks, they stand a much better chance if they have a crisis of staying in those homes. And so that's all in my testimony. In there is a chart that we did from the census data that does show a little bit about some facts about where home rates have gone compared to, or home purchase prices have gone compared to income. And you can see that during the 90s, it's 90 to 2000, so the data is 3 years old, but it's out of the census, that we had a huge run-up, actually the highest in the nation. We lost more affordability than any other state in the nation between 90 and 2000, so there needs to be something done about home ownership in the state. And with that, I will entertain any questions.
Why don't we need to answer. Okay. We'll hold the questions.
Great. Thank you.
Dear Chair Close and committee members, my name is Ian Slingerland, and I am providing testimony today on behalf of the Community Alliance of Tenants. The Community Alliance of Tenants is a statewide tenant membership renters' rights organization, and we'd like to as well commend the initiative and efforts behind House Bill 2639. The affordable housing crisis in our state is staggering, and we need to use all the tools and resources we have available to address it. HB 2639 represents a good step, but it alone is inadequate. We urge you to consider all potential affordable housing tools presented to your committee. We ask that you schedule hearings for House Bill 2595, a bill that would remove bad current law that ties the hands of local governments and reduces the tools available to meet the challenges of the affordable housing crisis. House Bill 2595 does not itself impose any new taxes or fees, but it does provide the citizens of localities across the state to have those as tools available to them as they struggle with the crisis that they face. The Community Alliance of Tenants operates a renter's rights hotline. And on our hotline, we come face-to-face with the impact of the affordable housing crisis every day. Tenants call because they are unable to keep up with rising housing costs and face eviction for non-payment of rent. Tenants call desperately searching for scarce affordable housing opportunities. And tenants call as they struggle with deplorable conditions that they can't find their way out of because of the cost of moving and the lack of other options. As an example, I'd like to share two hotline calls that we received in the last week alone. Excuse me.
Ian, I'll ask you to summarize those in the interest of time.
Okay.
I'll read it all.
Okay. In the first, a woman called because her son had been laid off and so was evicted from his former housing, and she invited him to stay with her while he had time to find a new job and get back on his feet. Unfortunately, her lease required that for him to stay more than 2 weeks, that he be added to the lease. But he was unable to meet the screening criteria because of the past eviction. And so the woman was faced with the terrible choice between facing eviction herself or putting her son and granddaughter on the street. And another call, it was a woman recounted her struggle to break out of an abusive relationship. She had recently kicked the abuser out of her home, but was now unable to pay rent because her income itself was insufficient. So the affordable housing crisis really is tremendous, and it has a devastating impact on all the families that it touches. Families are forced to make unthinkable choices between health and homelessness, food or rent. And so we believe that the legislature must act to provide all the available tools to respond to this crisis. We support House Bill 2639, but we believe that you need to recognize that it alone is very inadequate, and we urge you to schedule a hearing for House Bill 2595 as well. In no way do I want to discount the incredible work that the realtors have done on this bill, but and while it's one bite at a time, it doesn't make sense to ignore other bites that are available. And acting on 2639 while failing to act on other options that are available seems somewhat akin to feeding a starving person with a cracker while hiding a pantry's worth of food behind you. So we really urge you to act in support of House Bill 2639 and schedule a hearing for House Bill 2595 as well. Thanks for your consideration.
Thank you, Ian. And I want you to know we're trying to weigh. We've heard that we need 20,000 new homeowners to keep up with the national average. And so we're weighing if putting on a new fee might actually decrease people buying homes. We have to be careful we don't do that as well. So we will consider that carefully. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm certainly sympathetic to comments, and since we voted yesterday on a bill that may potentially raise the purpose of the housing trust fund, clearly the problem is getting worse, not better, and the bill is a drop in the bucket. But given that it is at least a drop in the bucket, we want to make sure that it does the most good. And the thing I wanted to ask, and I guess it's for John or Jack, either of you, is the language in the bill now calls for the broker or the escrow agent to seemingly direct where the funds from this interest will go. And I'm wondering if we couldn't tighten this up so that we ensure that those funds are hooked into the existing programs that Housing and Community Development is involved in right now, rather than, I mean, it wouldn't make any sense to me to set up a whole new program, and we want these funds to be directed where they'll do most good. So is there a way that could be clarified, do you think?
Chair Close, Representative Rosenbaum, I believe that could be clarified through amendments. In brief conversations with the realtors, it is, of course, their desire to make sure that there's high participation of realtors. But I believe that, again, our programs do demonstrate, do have an excellent track record. So I believe the answer to your question is yes.
Representative McQuaidie.
Thank you. This question is really for the realtors, if they'd like to comment, or for any of you who have been in dialogue with them. That is, whether you've considered making it a situation where the default position is that money would go into a trust account and the interest would go to affordable housing unless the parties all agreed in writing that either the money would go to the broker or the money would go to, for that matter, to anywhere else. Has there been discussion which might raise participation while still leaving the voluntary participation and flexibility that's being proposed? If anyone would like to comment.
Chair, Close Representative Merkley, to my knowledge that those conversations have not taken place yet, although it seems like a reasonable approach.
And we can pursue that later, but let me I'll also ask whether the current housing programs would qualify under the Public Benefit Corporation. Could the funds under this currently go to, I don't want to say the Housing Trust Fund, because that's not the place I want to put money right now, but to the programs the department is involved in?
Chair, Close Representative Merkley, I won't claim to be an expert on public benefit corporations. I did look at the roster of public benefit corporations from the Secretary of State's office, and it is non-religious, non-profit organization. I'll have to get back to you with the answer on that. I'm not sure.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Garrard.
Mr. Blatt,
yes.
You made reference earlier that the bill refers to first-time homebuyers and not low-income homebuyers. Are not most first-time homebuyers low-income homebuyers?
I don't precisely know the answer to that question in terms of most. My groups and the programs that the state runs fund people what we refer to as 80% of area median income. Median income is the level at which half the people make more than that in the area and half the people make less. And so the state's programs target people who are at 80% of that median number. And that's what we call low income. If most of them fall, I don't know the number, I don't know the percentage of overall first-time homebuyers that that would fall into that category. I know when I was a first-time homebuyer, I probably didn't fall into that category, but I don't know what the overall number is.
Thank you.
Representative Shoffman.
I think this bill is a step in the right direction. It is not going to come anywhere near solving our problems, which are huge, and I'm in sympathy of that, and I wish I could find a gold mine and solve it right now. But as far, and I know we aren't talking about transfer tax, but we are. this graph here, if we put a transfer tax on, this line is going to even get steeper, which is going to make it more difficult for this individual to buy a home. So really, I mean, if you just do simple math and project it out, we would be creating a situation where it would be even more difficult, not just for poor folks, but for working folks to get in a house. And I know maybe some other people that are smarter than me can explain to me how that would work, but I have a hard time understanding how adding any kind of a transfer tax on would help get people into a home. Maybe the low-income folks, but I think it would be more difficult for working folks. And I think all we'd be doing is, if this were a line of income, we'd just be shifting the problem up like this. And I don't know, I have a hard time understanding that one. Thank you.
Thank you very much, panel. We're going to move to our last panel, which is Jack Monroe and Randy Tucker.
Good
comment there, anything.
Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm appearing today on behalf of the Oregon Land Title Association, and we certainly commend the objective of the sponsors. And I'm here really to point out only two issues: one of which is a policy issue, the other of which is technical. Current law, and Representative Merkley, I think, properly identified the issue in an earlier question. Current law, and I'm referring to Section 2, allows for the use of interest-bearing escrow accounts with the benefits to inure to either the principals or the escrow agent under the conditions that are noted in the section. And the amended language creates a situation where you obviously can have an interest-bearing trust account, but the principal, I think, is inadvertently left out in discussing this bill with the sponsors. I think there's probably been a drafting problem here. It's not an option to create an interest-bearing escrow account with the interest inuring to the benefit of the principals. And I'm not sure, as a matter of policy, that's something you want to do. But I would tell you that in the escrow world, frankly, interest-bearing accounts are not the norm because essentially small amounts of money are held for very short periods of time. So particularly in this day and age, not a great deal of interest is generated. But there are certainly transactions where an interest-bearing account makes a lot of sense, and probably the most obvious one is a complex commercial transaction where there might be a lot of money that's held in escrow and interest would be generated. But again, the way this revised language is set up, it would not be possible to set up an escrow account with the interest inuring to the benefit of the principals. And so I guess I leave that policy issue with you. The other just more technical drafting issue is that there's not consistency in the language in Section 2, in that sub 1, which continues to exist, refers to these in small lowercase as escrow accounts, which is really the terminology used in the industry. And the new language refers to something called a client's trust account, which is notably, or you know, seemingly a different animal. So when we go back through and make any necessary amendments, we would think it appropriate to make that language consistent. With that, I'd be happy to respond to any questions you might have.
We'll go to Randy next, and then we'll go to
Thank
questions.
You.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Randy Tucker, 1000 Friends of Oregon. As most of you know, we're a nonprofit organization founded in 1975 by Henry Richmond and Governor Tom McCall to support the effective implementation of Oregon's land use planning program. And you may not think of us as the affordable housing people, but in fact, we have for years strongly integrated housing affordability into our work. We promote compact, livable communities with a range of housing for all incomes in every community. We spearheaded the formation of the Coalition for a Livable Future, which is an alliance of community groups dedicated to addressing the links between a variety of issues, including land use, urban design, transportation choices, and affordable housing. And in 2001, we hired a new staff member to fill a new position specializing in affordable housing and urban design. Affordable housing is a critical element of sound planning and, as has been said, of complete and livable communities. Building communities that integrate affordable housing is also very closely linked with transportation. When we think about affordable housing, we need to factor in transportation into the equation. And so that makes it especially important to provide affordable housing in every neighborhood, in every community. Because being able to live near your work and near where you need to go and services on a daily basis basically lowers your overall cost of living by making more of your income available for housing or other needs. So that's just a little overview of why we care about affordable housing or some of the reasons. With respect to affordable housing, we believe, or most of what I wanted to add today has been said, so I'll be very brief here. We believe we need more tools in the toolbox. Over the years, the legislature has taken several actions that have actually removed tools from the toolbox. A couple of sessions ago, it was inclusionary zoning. We also, as you know, have a preemption, as has been mentioned, on use of real estate transfer fees. This bill is a step in the right direction. It seems innocuous enough, but as many people have said, it won't do It won't come anywhere near addressing the actual needs that we face, and we would urge you to have a broader discussion about how to address these various serious needs that are facing our communities. We hope that discussion will include consideration of putting more tools back into the hands of the local governments who are grappling with these issues, including hearing of House Bill 2595. Thank you, Madam Chair, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Representative Merkley.
Thank you very much. Jack, you referred to current law and allows the interest to inure to the benefit of the principal. Could you explain that to us?
Well, the first sentence in the in subsection 2, which is being struck, actually allows for the creation of an interest-bearing account, the proceeds of which could go to the principal or actually could go to anybody. And so that language is being struck. And if you look at the new language, essentially the choice you might have in one of those situations in the future is, I guess, for me to look at you, assuming you're the principal, and say, you know, this is good news, bad news. We can create an interest-bearing checking or an interest-bearing client's trust account. The bad news is you'll have to determine whether or not the interest will go to me or to this public corporation that we've created here.
So just to clarify, currently if my funds are in trust because I'm involved in a transaction, let's say that they're in trust 6 months and then the transaction collapses, currently I could benefit from the interest because it's my money and the law allows it.
Yes.
Under this law, I would have to either say I want that money to go to a nonprofit or to a broker.
That's correct. Well, or I'm not a broker or an escrow agent.
Or an escrow
that's
agent.
Who I'm speaking.
Okay, I just wanted to be
right
clear
now.
About that
that's,
shift in
I mean, we
structure.
We have precluded with this new language. And as I indicate, this was not, as I understand it, intentional. It you know, I think represents a drafting error, but that would not be possible.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. Appreciate that.
Well, thank you very much, panel. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And thank you, everyone, who testified, keeping your comments concise and to the point, and we've been able to move quickly. I promised to call the realtors back up for questions, so I'm going to call Janet Jarvis and Harlan Levy to answer questions that have arisen since they were last testifying. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Janet Jarvis. I'm with the Oregon Association of Realtors. Harlan did me the favor of providing the testimony this morning because I'd been dealing with a bit of a family crisis. And so I think there are a couple of points that he did not make I'd like to clarify, if I may. The purpose of this bill, the simple purpose of this bill, was that I saw when I was traveling back among our others with other state government affairs directors an opportunity for us to participate in this problem. And several states outside of Colorado have enacted legislation that have allowed them to create private foundations to assist median to low income first time home buyers. Obviously, we're not talking about affordable housing in the larger sense of rent subsidy type of programs, but we're talking about down payment assistance to first-time home buyers, because we have a very strong vested interest in helping Oregonians become home owners in the state. We think it has a lot of positive societal values, et cetera, but the fact of the matter is that was the nature of what this was all about. I'm surprised to see so much reaction at this particular hearing this morning. I thought this was kind of a no-brainer, but in any event, what we have been precluded by law was to create these interest-bearing accounts. I have looked briefly at the Colorado program. I know Massachusetts, I believe, has a program, and I believe a couple of other state realtor associations have a program. And my intention was to fix the statute so we could begin to participate in that. And in doing that, I would anticipate us setting up a private foundation that would include some of the low-income advocates on it. That's exactly the kind of program that's been created across the country with our other realtor associations. You know, when you take a look at the kinds of dollars that could be created, and even if it was just 100 new homeowners a year, that's 100 more than you would have had otherwise. We're currently precluded from interest-bearing accounts, and so my interest, of course, is to find a way to leverage more people into homes. And so if you look at the cost of a private foundation versus running this through a state agency, I think we could get a higher return, and that's the intention, is to create a private foundation that would have a very narrowly defined charter as to who they could help, but would also be able to respond to market conditions. If we define it in statute as, you know, 80% on median income, it's possible in changing economic times that those individuals couldn't qualify for a mortgage, and we wouldn't be able to help anyone if we were doing down payment assistance. So those are the kind of things we would draft into the charter, and we would have all kinds of players at the table that would sit on the board to participate in that. In terms of Jack's amendments that he brought forward for the escrow folks, that was a drafting error. We're in agreement. We have no problem with those amendments.
Erwin?
Thank you, Chair Close. I just wanted to add one thing for the committee. I apologize for my math skills. I went to law school in order to avoid math. And in fact, 500,000 divided by 5,000 is 100. Apologize for that.
Long night, right? Questions for the panel. Representative Gallego, and then Rickley.
Yes. Is there anything in this bill that would preclude in the interest-bearing account from the parties involved being able to say the interest born out of this would go to a different charity that I choose? Or are we trying to keep it very narrow to where if some of these public existing housing organizations wanted to compete and organize themselves that way, is there anything that would preclude them from making a choice?
This bill simply changed the statute and allows us to create interest-bearing accounts. Right. And so we would have a variety of options. But our intention, and I would want to state it on the record, is to use those funds to help first-time home, you know, down payment assistance.
Representative McQueen.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Jenna, for bringing this idea to Oregon from your colleagues around the nation. I like the idea of taking funds that are and their earnings that are not that are currently kind of disappearing into the vapor, if you will, and applying them to a good purpose. I'm trying to get clarification on a few of the details. As I read current law, it does allow interest-bearing accounts, but only with the written approval of all parties who have an interest in the trust funds. And I was under the impression that Jack had, that in some cases currently I can arrange, if I'm putting money into a trust fund, to earn the interest on my own money while it's in trust. And so I want to be a little cautious about taking someone's earnings on their own money and transferring it elsewhere. I just want to kind of ponder that piece of the puzzle. But several people have had a few ideas here, and I understand you're in conversation with some of the advocates who have mm-hmm. testified to try to mm-hmm. work on some of those ideas, and I would just express my support for that conversation. I think you've brought a very interesting mechanism to us, and thank you.
Chair Close, Representative Merkley, to respond to your first comment, you're right. Currently, if a realtor hands a written note to a client and asks them to sign, they can put that in an interest-bearing account. Well, as a practical matter, they're not going to do that. And what we're looking for simply is to be able to post a notice, so to speak, in their office that would say your funds are going in an interest-bearing account for this purpose type of thing. And that's really the change in the statute, is the type of notification.
Prior written notice as opposed to prior written approval.
Yes.
I see.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much for bringing this bill. We will look forward to your amendments.
Thank you.
And it's a very wonderful idea, and we're looking forward to seeing how this will continue in Colorado, and watch their numbers as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Close.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2639. And committee, we have two more bills to hear in a half an hour. There are a number of people signed up to testify, so we're intending to allow about 15 minutes each. We probably will need to bring these bills back so everybody can have the time they need. However, this morning we want to get them both in. So that's the way we'll do it. And I'm going to turn the gavel over to Representative Rosenbaum, and she will conduct those hearings.
Did you open the public hearing?
No.
Okay, I'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2714 and making the essentials that the bill does.
Okay, Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2714 expands the definition of electrical installations for the purposes of electrical safety law to include the disconnection or demolition of electrical wiring and the permanent attachment or disconnection of electrical product that is not itself an electrical product. Thank you.
Thank you. First, we'll call Jared Redford. Jared?
Good morning. Thank you, Vice Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jared Broadfoot with PacWest Communications. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon chapters of the National Electrical Contractors Association, over 500 contractors throughout the state with an average of 10 employees per contractor. We are in support of House Bill 2714, and just want to identify, first of all, that the word demolition, we would like to remove that from the bill. We think that that goes a little bit too far of what the intent of when we had it drafted. So we're willing to remove the word demolition or to come up with the definition of demolition. And the intent here was to provide further electrical safety, not only for consumers but for the people that are doing the work. It takes a high level of skill to install electrical wiring. You have to be licensed in the state to do so, and what we want to get at is have the licensed individuals disconnect the wires as well. It's a safety issue. So we are in full support and urge the committee to pass the bill when the time comes. But we are willing to work. We've worked with Building Codes Division in the past week to identify that technical problem and would be willing to remove it.
Thank you. And are you preparing amendments then to that effect? Or?
Yes, we will be preparing amendments to do that, yes.
Questions of the witness?
I do have a comment. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I saw the demolition in there, and I was kind of worried about that because I've had the happy opportunity of doing a lot of demolition, and I don't think Sparky wanted to do that work. All I wanted him to do was tell me it was all shut off. But thanks for doing that.
Yes, through the Vice Chair, Representative Schaffler. Yes, that we that would go a little bit too far. We certainly don't want to have our licensed electricians responsible for demolishing buildings and
so on. Madam Chair, they could always come and lend a hand.
Yeah.
Representative Berkley.
Madam Chair, thank you. I was just kind of smiling to myself as I read the language because it almost sounds like if you unplug an appliance that you're in violation here given the definition of electrical product and disconnect.
Vice Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Merkley, no, it would not apply to unplugging a cord from the wall by any means. So
thank you for that clarification for the record.
Other questions of the witness? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we'll call Rick Thomas.
Good morning, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rick Thomas, Executive Director of Independent Electrical Contractors of Oregon. Also here this morning in support of House Bill 2714. I believe it's important that when demolition is taking place that products are properly disconnected before work takes place on that. That being said, we're also in support of removing demolition from Section 1, Subsection 9 of the bill, as our position, as long as it's properly disconnected the power to the structure, that demolition should be able to take place by people that are skilled in demolition of structures. Keeping it brief, we just appreciate your support of this bill. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you for your testimony. And next we'll call Lee King and Mike Van Laer.
Okay.
And Mike,
My name's Mike Van Lair, with the Steelworkers, and the chair knows that we lost 300 jobs within this last 3 years from our plant alone, and I'm scared that by changing the laws like you're doing with electrical licenses, we're going to lose more, and by giving the operation or the company the right to bring in outside contractors to do some of the work that we are doing now. We are licensed electricians and everything, but by changing these laws, I want to make sure that you are aware that it does have an effect on the manufacturing corporations in your state. So that's my only comment. Thank you.
Madam Chair, may I?
Sir, may I?
There's a question, Representative
Kaplan. Thank you. So, the folks that are doing this work right now and where you work at are licensed
electricians.
They've been through apprenticeship
programs. They've been through apprenticeship programs and other schooling tied to safety and et cetera. But I just want to make sure that the company doesn't take the changes that are made in these laws and say, okay, it says here it has to be an outside contractor or a contractor and takes jobs away from the steel workers or other people that are working in factories. That's my biggest concern.
Thank you.
Any other?
Other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Testimony. And our last witness is Jerry Schmidt. Jerry?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm here today representing the Oregon Groundwater Association. We saw the bill and just were curious about its effects and what the proponents of the bill were proposing. We haven't had a chance to really digest it. Our concern, of course, would be is that we do fall under these statutes, members of the Oregon Groundwater Association, who are limited pump installation specialty contractors under the law. And my question, of course, was just to make sure how this was affecting folks. Our industry deals with both potable and irrigation water to both domestic and irrigation users. Primarily, my concern would be with the rural users because in those instances, our contractors are out helping people in rural America. If, in fact, there is a change that would require an electrician in addition to the pump specialty license to be at a installation when we're undergoing some changes, I guess I'm commenting generally about both bills, and that's the reason why I was here, was just to hear testimony and try to understand what the proponents of the bill were trying to do. So with that, I just wanted to go on the record to say that we're willing to work with the proponents and see what issues are being uncovered here, and we're supportive of it. With that, thank you very much.
Questions of this witness? Okay, thank you for your testimony. So that completes our testimony on House Bill 2714. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2714. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2718 and call Jerry Bradford. Welcome back.
Thank you. Vice Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, again for the record, my name is Jared Broadfoot here from PacWest Communications on behalf of the National Electrical Contractors Association. I brought up with me Tim Nickel from the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 280 as well. The intent of House Bill 2718 was, again, geared towards safety. And the type of work, this bill specifically references the amount of volts to ground that a person holding a limited maintenance electrician's license can do work on. So the intent there, again, was aimed at safety. And I will let Tim kind of elaborate on that. He's our technical expert, and then I'll give some final comments.
Madam Chair and committee, just a short aside, all the talk this morning about my friend here and his lack of sleep due to the new baby, I'd just like you to know that I recently became a grandfather for the first time. I am sleeping soundly with a smile on my face. That said...
in addition to that clarification, would you like to identify yourself for the record?
Yes. That being said, my name is Tim Nickel. I'm with the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 280. I represent members in 6 counties in the Willamette Valley and 3 counties in Central Oregon. I first became aware of this issue a couple years back when I was part of a committee to do 3-year rule review for electrical safety law and building codes. And so what I've done is I've asked building codes to supply me with some facts on this issue. The LME license is a license that allows for repair, maintenance, and replacement of existing electrical installation or components. This license is primarily used in industrial locations, schools, hospitals, and government entities. This license does not allow for any new installations nor for work on electrical services. There have been several grandfather provisions in recent memory. The latest ended on December 31st, 2000, and required no apprenticeship or specialized training programs. There are approximately 2,400 licensed LMEs in the state, and there are currently no apprenticeship programs currently offered that provide the specialized training necessary to work on electrical systems greater than 600 volts. Just for a little technical aside, the National Electrical Code kind of separates itself between under 600 volts and over 600 volts. Systems over 600 volts require special knowledge of safety for personnel, specialized equipment, and special provisions of the electrical codes. 99.9% of LMEs work on systems of 480 volts or less. And as another technical clarification, the bill came out stating 480 volts to ground, and what we really mean is 480 volts phase to phase. Now, I discovered this morning there are people around that don't really know a lot about electrical theory, so a real quick one for you. When we're talking about voltage, we're talking about the pressure behind the electricity. When we're talking amperage, we're talking the amount of electricity. So the voltage is that pressure by which that electricity is flowing. Like I said, 99% of the LMEs work on systems of 480 volts or less, so the impact of this bill would be very small. Under current statute, a person could have completed an apprenticeship program or been licensed through a grandfather provision, and then go to work at a sawmill or industrial facility that has 4,160 volts, or as high as 12,500 volts, electrical systems. Without the specialized training necessary, the potential for an accident that could cost lives or loss of property exists. This change in statute would provide the degree of direction necessary to have safe electrical installations with properly trained individuals performing the work and provide clear direction to industrial locations on the use of their staff. I must admit that until I walked in and signed the sheet this morning, I didn't know there was anybody in opposition to this bill, and I'm not the type that wants to just pass legislation just because I think it's a good idea, even though I think this is a good idea. I'm totally happy to work with anybody else on fixing the technical aspects of this bill to make it perfect. Thank you.
I have
questions of these witnesses? Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. Mr. Nickel, the guys that are, I don't know how many there are in Oregon, that are grandfathered under this who may be working on electrical wiring that is higher than they're certified at, you all are willing to work with those workers to bring them up to their certification requirements so that they aren't displaced by somebody from outside. You see where my concern here?
Exactly. I can't honestly tell you how many people are actually working on systems higher than 480 volts phase-to-phase at this time. According to building codes, it sounds like a very small amount. What we kind of were worried about when we first thought of this issue was the fact that there are people coming into these situations that somebody might have an LME license working in a government entity, for example, and because of the economy end up working in a sawmill, and the next thing you know they're working, you know, behind some switchgear or something that's got live, you know, extremely explosive voltage And we don't want to see an accident happen.
Madam Chair. Yeah. And yet, that's not the situation I'm talking about.
I know. You're talking about us willing to train
somebody's people. Been there 20 years and things change. And that's the. I don't want to displace that work.
Right.
That's my concern. Now, somebody that's jumping from job to job, then they should recertify, get reeducated, continuing ed, whatever the terminology is.
Well, through Madam Chair, to Representative Schaffler, in our industry, we provide training. Along with NECA and IBW, we provide a vast amount of training, continuing education, and upgrading continuing education. What I would hope is that these few people that might be working on these systems that are that high, this would force their employers to make sure that they gave them the necessary training.
Okay, thank you. That's what I would like to see, too.
Representative Ferrari, do you have a question?
And I don't know which of you gentlemen would prefer to answer this, but as a former broadcaster, I had a concern because most media, radio, television, employ what's commonly referred to as a chief engineer who do the service on the equipment, and almost all media, radio, television, do have a whole bunch of high voltage involved in that. Does this bill affect someone who holds a first class FCC license? I guess the question is that person considered an electrician, a licensed electrician, by the federal licensing requirements? Does that automatically apply to them in this situation? And I realize it may be a narrow question.
Through the chair, to Representative Gard, I think I understand what you're saying. And if I read the law right, and from what my experience is, the federal license really doesn't interconnect in any way with the state of Oregon electrical licensing laws. So I would imagine that somebody with a first-class FCC license, if they're doing maintenance and repair on this broadcasting equipment, probably is already in possession of an LMC license, so they'd be legal in the state of Oregon. This is something that's already. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. The current law that allows the limited maintenance electrician's license, has that been in place for a long period of time?
I haven't been involved with the state government and building codes for more than 5 years now, and so I really couldn't answer that question, but I'd be glad to find out.
Yeah, but through the Vice Chair, Representative Merkley, I'm not aware when the limited maintenance electrician's license was put into place, but we can for sure obtain that information from the Building Codes Division.
Thank you. Follow-up, Madam Chair. I guess I'd be curious to know if there have been any accidents that reflect that the training that these individuals received have been inadequate. Is there a problem here that we're fixing? That would be the question. I'd like to see if you could get back to us and let us know if there's been any difficulties here or if this is more preventative in nature.
Vice Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Merkley, I think the attempt here is twofold. One, preventative, absolutely, and the other being if there have been, and we can certainly pull certain examples of where this would have helped. But in Tim's testimony, he referenced that the only training program for this, for the limited maintenance electrician license, only trains up to 600 ground volts. What our attempt here is to make sure that and the state has taken a very strong stance on licensed electricians, licensed trades for that fact, and the type of work they can do. And Tim is actually a member of the State Electrical and Elevator Board, and that board has taken a strong position that in order to do electrical work, certain types of electrical work, you have to be licensed, and there are requirements there. We feel that setting this this bar, the 480 phase-to-phase and 277 to ground volts, would promote safety and also stick with the current situation with the board and with the state at the levels that we've set as far as having licensed electricians, trained individuals do the work and preventing them from not only harming themselves but harming others. So, and we can get those in there for you.
I have a question. I'm curious, given that the training program does train people up to 600 volts, how you arrived at the 480 volt figure that's in the bill? For either of you to answer.
Right. Madam Chair, in an industrial situation and a governmental type situation, like in this building, for example, the voltage comes in on a transmission line at a much higher voltage, probably 4160, and gets transformed down to a very reasonable 480 volts phase to phase, of which each one of those phases to ground would be 277 volts, and that's what the voltage on these lights are. They use that in place of in industrial situations and in places like this, in place of what you'd have in your house, which is a much smaller voltage, because it's cost effective to use higher voltage, but yet that break in the National Electrical Code where when voltages get up over 600 volts, it becomes a lot more dangerous, so they have to limit that in this situation.
I'm with you that far, but I don't understand why you didn't use 600 instead of 480.
Well, it's because of other situations, Madam Chair. It's I don't really know why it came out stating 480 volts to ground myself. I don't know why it didn't match the other license just down the page here a little bit, the limited building maintenance electrician, and say 300 volts to ground, which would probably say the same thing. We're willing to work on getting the exact wording in there to make it have the right effect.
And Vice Chair Rosenbaum, I think the difference between 480 phase to phase and the, or 480 ground volts and 600, the systems that are they're in between those two, there are very few of them. So we are more than willing to look at raising that up to 600 so we can be right in line with the National Electrical Code. But the there's just very few systems in there. So we felt that we set it at 480 that we'd be setting the line as far as the lighting systems, switches, those types of products.
And Tim, has the electrical board taken a position on your knowledge that they considered it?
No, actually, Representative Rosenbaum, the electrical board actually, like I say, we had the electrical board assigns a committee to do rule review, okay, every 3 years. And when it comes to the actual bills and the electrical board not taking a position or not, what basically happens is Mark Long just comes and puts on a presentation every month, keeping us updated on the bills. We really don't make a statement on the bills themselves.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next, we'll call Bill Cooting. And our next two witnesses are Mike Van Laer and Lee King, if you'd like to come forward, too.
Thank you, Madam Chair Rosenbaum and committee. My name is Bill Cluding. I'm representing the Western Council of Industrial Workers here in the Northwest and Oregon. We have over 4,000 working members in this state. We run the lumber and sawmill, anything to do with timber facilities in this state. I was a licensed limited maintenance electrician for 23 years, and 5 years ago, I went back to school and picked up my limited supervisor's license. To do any of this, I had to serve a four-year apprenticeship. What those six words does on line 44 on page 2 curtails a lot of activities that licensed limited electricians do in the plants in this state, not only in the lumber industry, but very few industrial complexes out there in this state are limited to 440 volts or less to ground, 480 volts or less to ground. These six words would a plant industrial facility would have to reevaluate their whole electrician's crew. They would have to bring in certain breakdowns or maintenance times, they would have to bring in outside electrical contractors, which would drive the maintenance labor cost almost out of sight, especially for plants that are in this tough times that are very small profit margin or no profit. It could possibly cause a plant to close down. I don't, with this wording, I'm not sure a limited licensed person could even unlock the transformer vault in their industrial plant and go in and throw the main switch gear. And also, transformers need maintenance yearly and monthly. Again, you'd have to call in an outside contractor to do that. Each year, a license holder has to, in 3 years, you have to have 24 hours of state electrical upgrade, which it's easy to do 8 hours a year, but each year to maintain your license, you have to do your 24 hours upgrade in 3 years, which is your new safety factors, your new electrical decision changing that has been made. This license we're talking about here, the word limited is it pretty well defines it. They are limited to industrial facilities, schools, hospitals, etc. That license is not allowed to go on the outside. That's not our expertise. Again, when you bring in an outside contractor, that person doesn't know the internal workings of this plant. It doesn't. A lot of these people are experts in their field on the outside, but you get them inside of a working plant that at that time is not working. The downtime factor is for that time, it drives sky high. Also, all industrial companies maintain very strict safety rules, and these license holders follow all state electrical safety rules, and any new changes are immediately brought online. I urge you to vote no on House Bill 2718, and I will try to answer any questions. Thank you.
Representative Burrard.
Bill isn't under the current licensing requirements of a journeyman electrician. Aren't they permitted to work on anything up to 300 volts to ground under present law?
Our people right now can work. For an example, when our mill in Dallas went down, one of our electricians went to a paper mill in Newburgh. His license and training in our complex allowed him to work on motors of 2,000, 4,000 horsepower and voltage above. Is that the answer you're looking?
Well, in the bill on page 3, I'm not sure which section we're talking to. It must be still section 1, 11A. It says a person licensed under this subsection is authorized to maintain, and then I'm going to skip a couple sentences, electrical systems not exceeding 300 volts to ground.
Maybe I could just clarify. It looks like that is the definition of a limited building maintenance electrician license, and the section that the bill is changing is a limited maintenance
Yes, we're on the license. Representative Rosenbaum Yard, we're on page 2, line 44, which is the changes. The actual line 42 is the actual electrician's license that we're talking about.
This committee went through a lot of discussion last session about licensing that restricts what people can do. Mm-hmm. So there are these nuances of different licenses. I don't know how many different licenses we have under the electrical code, but I know there are a lot of them.
Follow, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
So under current existing law,
right?
What is that electrician allow? What's the maximum number of voltage to ground that individual is licensed to?
With a limited maintenance electric license?
Yes.
Right now,
today's law.
Right now, there is not a limit.
Thank you. Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would picture that a lot of the work that is, at the time the work is done, power is turned off to the, say, the motor. And so at that point, the voltage to ground is zero unless there's a capacitance in the particular appliance. And I'm assuming then that if, in under normal, the reason we don't hear about a lot of accidents here is because essentially, the stuff is turned off when it's being worked on. Is that? Am I getting a correct picture of the situation?
Madam Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Merkley, yes. There is very strict electrical code laws, OSHA laws, and I think you will find that the industry, their self-governing safety laws, are even stricter than what the state laws are. I have been through many, many, many safety sessions with my ex-employer, and every one of them is safety-driven.
If I can continue, I believe our voltage household is 110 to 120. Europe is 220 to 240, more or less. And so phase-to-phase in residential wiring in Europe is identical to this, which is roughly 480, that is, residential wiring 180 degrees out of phase.
Representative Rosenbaum, Representative Meekley, what comes into your house 99% of the time is 220 single phase, which can be divided in your panel board down to 110 of two different phases, or 220 to feed your 220 appliances.
Okay, so in European wiring, it's 220 just left in a single phase.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you, sir.
In
I
European
lost my hearing aid because.
Well, and I won't take the committee's time to go down this route. It occurred to me that if the structure in Europe was laid out the same as in America, where you have the two voltages out of phase with each other, that essentially this 480 would be roughly equivalent to what residential European wiring is. But let me not take more time with the with that right now.
Thank you.
Okay. One more, Representative
Chaplin. Thank you, sir, for coming. I'm not an electrician. Don't pretend to be one. I think the way I read it, the intent is to make sure that everyone who's doing this kind of work is licensed and certified and educated to a certain level. I think that's the concern and the intent. And I know my intent, and my intent is definitely not to displace any workers that are already doing this work. But how much more education would a limited maintenance electrician or limited building maintenance electrician need to get up to the level that they're talking about, or would this, does this just create a different level? Just so I get it all clear in my head. And would you all be opposed to, my concern is there's some fella out there that is digging into something that he's just not certified or licensed to do. That's my main concern. That's really all I care about. And we want to make sure that they are all certified and licensed. For you specifically, how much more education would you need to meet these requirements? How many hours or days or whatever? Please.
Madam Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Schaffer, for a limited maintenance, to get to the higher license, you would have to probably maintain like a 2-year apprenticeship working with the higher licensed person and then pass the state test. Even though you hold a license, you just can't automatically go, I'm going to take this test here, because that's a different field per se. But possibly you would have to go, even with your background, you would have to serve some sort of an apprenticeship and then take the state test and pass.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. We have 3 more witnesses, and we're going to try to get you all in. So if you could brief Mike Van Laer, Lee King, and Jerry Schmidt. And Jerry does not want to comment, so Mike and Lee, if you could come forward.
Madam Chair, I rise. I'm Lee King. I'm a licensed electrician, multiply licensed. I rise in opposition to House Bill 2718, primarily based at the present time on the exact wording in the line 44, I believe, on page 2 that we're talking about. In my plant, I work at Wachang in Albany, and there's a minimal amount of work that will be displaced by those folks who have a limited maintenance electrician license. Most of our folks have either a general journeyman license, as I do, or a limited manufacturing plant license. So there's a minimal amount of work that would be displaced by our folks. But because of the wording in this bill, it creates a problem for that small amount of work in our plant. I see a tremendous problem in other places of employment, and I sympathize with our friends with the electrical contractors and the IBEW. A safety issue we have to be sympathetic with, but I think adding these 6 words is going to harm our employment picture in the state. It'll displace workers. I think that it might be more appropriate to address the safety issue that we're concerned with, perhaps to do something to require an employer to provide the training for higher voltage work, if that's a concern, rather than just adding these 6 words that makes the picture hazy and a very blurry document as it is, considering we have, at one time, we had 17 different electricians' licenses in this state, and I'm not certain what it is now. Thank you.
My name's Mike Van Laer. I have over 38 years in electronics and electrical work. Last 12 years, I'm in instrumentation at Ormet, ALVAC. It's now called ALVAC Albany Plant. Like I stated before, we went from 460-plus employees to 163 in the last 3 years. This changing of the rules here, again, gives the company the opportunity to come back to us and say that we can get outside contractors to come in and do our jobs, which we've been doing. In my craft alone, we went from 12 individuals down to 3. And it does affect us because we take care of the furnaces. The big thing is, just like a spark plug in a car that ignites the gas, it has a big 12,000 volts plus on it. We start our furnaces, our gas burners, with the spark plug. Okay, and that would eliminate these jobs, the guys that are doing that job right now. Or they'd have to go out and get another upgrade in their license. At the present time, we are talking with the company about upgrading our licenses to all journeyman licenses. They stated that it'll take at least 1 year of being an apprentice to get that license. Another saying that we have in maintenance is that if the equipment's not broke, don't fix it. That means basically the program's going good the way it is. Why would we want to change it to do different on it? Answer some of your questions earlier. Okay, so I do have a background in radio and TV. The FCC license is for your frequencies, basically, to give you the proper licensing to work with the frequencies which the government owns, this week at least. And a license is required for that because there's a high power, especially when you're transmitting out. And you have to have licenses in the state of Oregon to do that. So, again, I don't know if the limited license that we are talking about, you know, if you have a vacuum tube with a big arc on it, you got a lot of voltage to ground. By putting that limit on it, it will change that license too. So just these little things that are in the background that nobody thinks about, that's what this affects. And the other question was, when did this license come about? It was about 12 years ago the license came about, because there was this big gap in there and everybody was trying to fill it. So if you have any other questions, I'd be more than happy. Thank you.
Representative Gerard has a question.
Either one of you may answer or both. In your opinion, what is the intent of this bill?
I believe that the intent is clearly to remove jobs based on the wording. Now, we have been told otherwise, and I agree with the safety considerations, but I think it can be, the safety considerations can be best dealt with other wording or another bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned the high voltage on spark plugs, and they have a high voltage because you want a big arc to make sure you light the furnace. What type of voltage are we talking about?
On that, the spark plugs alone, just like your cars, over 12,000 volts. Very little current, but you can get over 12,000 volts easily. Again, coming into our plant is 2160.
Are there significantly different safety issues involved with high voltage, low amperage devices such as spark plugs versus high voltage, high amperage devices like motors?
Would you repeat the question, please?
Yeah, I can barely hear you.
Are there significantly different safety questions involved in high voltage, low amperage devices like spark plugs versus high voltage, high amperage devices like some industrial motors?
The greatest issue is distance from the devices. You know, they're all dangerous, but a higher amperage will jump a greater distance than a lower amperage.
Voltage, you're correct. Okay, you have to. Electricity is similar to a water hose. Okay, the more pressure you have on your nozzle, the farther it will go out. The hose will go out. So that's the same thing with electricity. The more pressure you have, the farther that spark is going to jump.
Let me give you the question once again. Same voltage, different amperages, such as a spark plug versus a high amperage motor. Are we talking about different safety issues in terms of the type of training required?
Okay, Mike, I have to get your question correct. You're stating that a spark plug wire, okay, versus a motor, 480 volts, high current, okay, they both can kill you. Okay, but one kills you, like the 480 and the current can kill, cook you, basically, where the spark plug will give you a heart attack. So they both can kill, but they're different ways of killing. So you have to, when you get to that point, you know, of trying to limit the voltage that a person can work on, you basically have to take into account that he has to know that not only 480 can kill, but the 12K with the smaller amperage can kill too. And how it's, so it's, you can both needs a safety program.
Thank you.
Representative Bird.
And I'll make this very brief, Madam Chair. Earlier in testimony, it was discussed that before you work on high voltage equipment, you turn it off. But that's not particularly true with high voltage, is it not? In that you can have something turned off and still have a pretty good punch left in that line if you touch the wrong thing.
Yes, tremendously.
Thank you.
Just that's a typical example of a motor, if it's still freewheeling, it's just like a generator.
Right.
Or in a television, like you have capacitance, which is what I was referring to.
Okay. I think that completes our questions. We're running out of time. I'm sure this bill will be scheduled again for further discussion, but Jared, did you have a brief
comment? I just have one final comment.
Okay, thank you both.
You might have read the point anymore.
For the record, Jared Broadfoot with National Electrical Contractors Association. Pure and simple, the intent of the bill was safety. The intent of the bill was not to put people out of jobs. We employ over 5,000 contractors, and IBEW employs thousands of electrical workers. We did not want to put people out of jobs. As stated by, and actually the information that we have obtained from the Chief Electrical Inspector, there are currently no programs that train people over 600 volts. The bottom line here is that if you have a limited maintenance electrician's licensed, there are currently no programs to train you to over 600 volts. If you have been trained over that, if you have gone through a four or five-year apprenticeship program, then you should have a license to conduct this work anyway. We're only looking at the individuals who hold the LME licenses that are not properly trained. We do not want them working on systems that they're not trained on, just like we do not want a lawnmower mechanic working on a piece of logging equipment. So it's geared towards safety. We are absolutely willing to work with everyone who testified here today and have been working with building codes. So we will be prepared to bring amendments back next time. So
okay, thank you very much. Seeing no one further to come before us, I will adjourn the public hearing on House Bill 2718. And seeing nothing further to come before us today, the committee is adjourned. Thank you.